excuse.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Taylor.
What do you want?
Turn on the radio.
I'm talking to you. You're listening to Radio Stew on WGXC 90.7 FM Acre and 313.9 Transmission Arts, Experimental Sound Art, Radio Art, Transmission Art, Radio Theater, Free Jazz, Noise. You never know what you might hear on Radio Stew.
Broadcasting from Mobile 49 at the Wave Farm. If you're not familiar with Mobile 49, it's a very exciting place. It's an experimental research production facility which serves as a central component in Max Goldfarb's recent body of work. So this piece by Max Goldfarb is essentially an old fire truck that has been converted into a radio studio station transmitter location. And it's located on the Wave Farm property deep in the woods. And so I decided it would be fun to do a broadcast from here at midnight. And as I walked out here in the dark with a flashlight, I realized there might be wild animals, so we may have some friends joining us later on. Who knows? I'm not from around here, but I've been told that there's wild turkeys, deer, the occasional bear, maybe even some coyotes. Definitely a few moths. But I've got a candle burning and the doors are open, so the our furry guests are always welcome. It's Amanda Dawn Christie here. I'm an artist in residence at the Wave Farm right now, and very excited to be able to broadcast out of Mobile 49, deep in the woods of the Wave Farm. So what I'm presenting to you tonight, The Sounds That Got Away, is a collection of excerpts from my journal and notebooks that I kept while working on the film Spectres of Shortwave. Right now you hear me unzipping my jacket because it's warmer than you would imagine in a fire truck. So what you're going to be hearing in the background, I'm taking advantage of one of the lovely features of Mobile 49. There's a microphone installed on the roof, which I will highlight for you right now. Of course, right now not much is happening. But we do have some background sounds. Oh, there comes some wind. Yeah. So we've got some a microphone on the roof that will pick up the sounds of wind, leaves blowing in the distance, if any traffic, if any furry animals come visiting, I should be able to hear them as they crunch through the leaves and branches on their way. And the other sounds you'll be hearing in the background, which I'll bring up now, are contact microphone recordings that I made of the radio towers in Sackville when they were still standing. So these confused as to which channel I was raising the volume on. So the Radio Canada International shortwave towers were located in the Tantramar Marsh in Sackville, New Brunswick, from the late 1930s until about 2 years ago. Just to give you a bit of background before I start reading you the excerpts. They've been a subject of my research for the past 6 years, and they're the subject of the film I'm working on, of the notes I'll be reading you tonight, and as well as several other projects. The Radio Canada International shortwave site was built during Second World War to broadcast overseas to Europe and to Africa. It was situated there because geographically it was close to the ocean and the perfect location for hitting South America, Africa, and Europe, and they also broadcast to the Arctic. It's Canada's largest high-power international shortwave relay site, and in addition to broadcasting to half of the globe, they were also subcontracted by Radio China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and others from time to time to transmit their broadcasts as well. If you lived in the region, many people who lived there didn't really know what the towers were for. It was just a very striking part of the landscape. It was 13 towers. They were all about 400 feet tall. Well, they weren't all 400. Some were 150, some were 200. And they were connected by this wire webbing. And the antennas were actually the wires, not the towers. The horizontal wires sent the transmissions. And the way shortwave radio works is that it bounces between the surface of the Earth and the ionosphere, and it ricochets back and forth. And once it gets to around half of the sphere of the globe, then it drops off into space. So Sackville covered half of the globe, but not north-south. It was more like if you imagine Sackville was the North Pole and went down to the equator, kind of on a diagonal. So these towers were very striking if you lived in the region, because the location, the Tantramar Marsh, was a very, very flat landscape, actually below sea level. The ocean was held back by dikes. And in this flat landscape, seeing these tall vertical intrusions, they were very striking, and there were lots of red beacon lights to stop airplanes from hitting them. So at night, you had this glow of these red lights that were just a very... they were like landmarks. When you were coming home, you'd see the red lights and you're like, oh, I'm almost home. And so as I started making my film about them, I also began doing sound recordings, placing contact microphones on the towers. And because while these are sounds that you wouldn't normally hear if you were standing next to them, it's amplifying their vibrations. And the winds on the marsh were very high. They would get up to... they would get easily up to 50, 60 kilometers an hour sometimes, and sometimes more. So the winds out there are very high, and so the towers themselves, even though they were quite robust and strong to withstand the winds, there were still, they would vibrate like aeolian harps or piano strings or guitar strings in the wind. So I would clamp contact microphones on them to capture sounds that were inaudible to the human ear, and that's what you'll be hearing in the background of my reading tonight. So in the background of my reading will be a combination of the site-specific location sounds right here, right now, from Mobile 49, the microphone on the roof of the fire truck in the woods, and the contact microphones recordings that I made of the radio towers in between 2012 and 2014. And the site was, I should mention, the site was demolished in 2014. It was shut down in 2012 when there were serious budget cuts to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which were then shuffled on to Radio Canada International. And they figured everyone has satellite and internet these days. And, well, we all know that authoritarian governments can censor the internet, and we all know that there's places where you don't get a satellite or a cell phone signal, whereas shortwave pretty much always gets through, no matter what your geographic location or your financial means. You can build a radio receiver with some wire and a paperclip, but you can't really build a digital receiver as easily. So think it was a great loss when that site was torn down. And so, that's a bit of the background, what I will be reading you tonight. So, as I said, these are notes that I wrote in my journal and my notebook actually last summer after I'd finished filming. And I'll admit, I haven't actually read this journal since. I seem to recall that a running theme was sounds that I tried to record while filming that I never actually recorded. It seemed to be a recurring theme from my experience of the film was chasing after sounds I wasn't able to capture. Hence titling this reading, The Sounds That Got Away. The night before filming began, I was all alone on the site, standing in the middle of the field as a storm approached. The sky was purple and green, and the wind whistled through the towers like no wind whistling I'd ever heard. It was full of deep bass and baritone tones, harmonics and subharmonics, the towers standing against the green clouds like a choir chanting in droning tones. I had no camera, no sound gear with me. For the next 2 years, I chased this sound with a kit of microphones, preamps, recorders, waiting for it to happen again, hoping I would be present and ready. I camped out in storms, I waited, I spent nights in tents in the summer, I slept in vans in the winter, but I never heard it again. That sound never came again, not for me, not when I was there, and not when I was ready. And this would become a recurring theme for the project, the sounds that got away, the sounds I never captured. A film about sound, elusive radio waves, and the best sounds of all taunted me, presenting themselves always only in the moment when I was without my nets. I was filming on the site the last week that it was still active. Most of the transmissions had stopped, but Japan's contract went until the end of October. And so they continued transmitting after the last Canadian broadcast had been sent in July. They continued transmitting for Japan until October. I had a small crew of two. And on the last day, we were filming out in the transmission field. The RCI site supervisor informed us that they would begin transmitting to Africa from one set of antennas between Tower F and Tower H. And this would be happening from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. And we could not be there between those towers during that time due to high voltage RF radiation. I asked if we would be trapped out in the field until they finished broadcasting. And he said, no, you can drive back. You can drive past the antennas, as long as you don't stop. Just keep driving and don't stop. So we went out in the field and we were filming. It was in the morning and it was getting close to 10 a.m. when they would start broadcasting. 9:45, 9:50, 9:55. We were packing up and I kept urging the crew that we had to get going. They thought I was worried about the sunlight and the next shot. I thought they knew about the imminent radiation that would happen when they started broadcasting. When it finally became clear that the urgency was about radiation and not about the sunlight and making the next shot, we packed the van as quick as possible and were out of there within minutes, so we were on the safe zone. By 9:58, with 2 minutes to spare, we were out of the way. After filming a while longer in the safe zone further off, we packed the van to return back to the building. But it was only 10:30, and they were still transmitting to Africa. So we decided to drive through because they said it was safe. We put the windows down of the van and drove slowly past the active antenna. You could hear voices and music in the air, clearly and audibly, yet there were no speakers nearby. I don't know if it was the water molecules in the air resonating with the transmissions, or what it was, but there was sound. Clear sound, audible voices, clear music in the air, all around us, from no definite source. The sound was simply in the air. It was everywhere. Just like all the stories I had heard from locals. I had heard people tell me stories about hearing radio waves in the air when they lived nearby in the 1950s, and that they heard radio waves in the air from the clotheslines. I assumed people had been exaggerating, but here it was. I heard it for myself, and I had no sound equipment to record it. And even if I did, I couldn't stop the van. I decided to set up camp on the outskirts of the site. There was a small clearing at the edge of a public access road, with a cow pasture on one side, and the Radio Canada International site on the other. My tent was set up on a small, level piece of ground, next to a ditch, just beneath a no trespassing sign that read, "Danger, high voltage." After shooting a few camera tests, I went to bed shortly after midnight. Sometime after 1 a.m., I was startled awake by a most haunting and repetitive sound. It was as if a loud, resonant banging and clanging with an echo. It was as if someone, a very large someone, took a very large, heavy piece of metal and struck it on an equally large, hollow piece of metal with all of their force. But it was so loud, I couldn't imagine a human large enough or strong enough to create such a sound with their own strength. And yet there were no motors or mechanical sound, only the stillness of night, crickets, wind in the grass, and this, the sound repeated, but somewhat irregularly, like a massive, echoey, dysfunctional metronome. Clang. Clang, 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 clang. Sometimes it sounded as if it was coming closer, but I was certain that was only my imagination. Most likely it was a loose halyard wire or a vertical stay swinging in the wind and banging against a horizontal antenna, or perhaps even a tower and nothing more. Even so, it was frightening and I was too scared to leave the tent. If I had had some audio gear with me, I might have gathered the nerve to go out with the flashlight and try to record it. But here I was again, in the presence of an awe-inducing sound, with no device on which to record it. And so I stayed in the tent, listening, shivering, paralyzed with fear. I'm not sure how much time passed before I drifted off to sleep. But the morning was filled with mist and birdsong. I went out in search of that clanging sound several other times, armed with sound recording gear and emotionally prepared, ready to not be afraid. But as in latter instances, I sought out this sound, and it would never startle or surprise me again. In spite of my many attempts and future tenting excursions in various weather conditions, sleeping in the van, in lightning storms, tenting in the rain, I never heard the sound again. It was elusive, to be experienced in the moment only, and never to be recorded. This is not to say that I never experienced the same fear again. From that night forward, the sight instilled a certain chill in the early morning, like being watched. Or not so much like being watched, as like being in the presence of another invisible yet sentient being. Perhaps it was merely the presence of wildlife in the vicinity. There were a lot of deer, muskrats, foxes, partridge, and other animals. Maybe it was their eyes that I felt upon me. This chill only happened in one location, on the clearing beneath the tree at the corner of the public access road, and nowhere else. I always felt completely safe everywhere else, on the site itself, on the side of the highway. One night when I went in a lightning storm, I didn't even make it to the clearing. I had such a chill that I locked all the doors in the van, climbed into the back of the van, filmed through the open window, and realized I would most likely not capture any lightning. So I raised the windows as soon as I finished filming, climbed back into the front seat, and drove away as quickly as possible on those dirt roads without ever opening a door. Perhaps it was simply my imagination, or the sense of wild animals watching me, but it felt like something more, and I still can't say what it was. In late summer and early fall of 2013, a year after transmissions from this site had ceased, I began making excursions to the site with contact microphones to record the vibrations of the towers, halyard wires and vertical stays. I would hike out into the radio field by foot with my gear and a tool belt. The first few times I forgot to bring water, and hours in the hot sun and high winds quickly went to my head. Sunburn, windburn, dizziness, and fatigue slowed my progress. Soon, after a few trips, I had a solid routine and a kit that included bottles of water, sunscreen, and insect repellent. One day, while walking along the dirt service roads, I heard a rustling in the grass beside me. Something smallish was walking alongside me. When I stopped, it stopped. And when I started, it started. But it never showed itself. I was reminded of a story that one of the workers had told me a few years ago. He told me that there was once a security guard who would feed the foxes pieces of hot dogs. And before long, a family of foxes was living on the site somewhere, although no one had found their den. On one of my earlier visits, we were even confronted by a playful fox who ran up no less than 8 feet from us, jumped up in the air a few times while looking at us, and then ran away 10 feet, turned, looked at us as if to see if we would follow, jumped a few more times, ran away, looked back. He repeated this 3 or 4 times as if trying to play or get us to follow him. Here I was a few years later, alone in the radio field, with what I assumed to be a fox walking alongside me in the field, without seeing him. I assumed he was friendly and playful. I wanted to turn around and jump like he did a few years ago. But then I had to remind myself that this is a wild animal, and I had no guarantee that it was friendly or wanted to play, no matter how much I might have sensed it. I should write or tell a story about climbing the towers, but I don't know what to say. I didn't make it to the top of the first one. February 4th, 2014, at 7:30 a.m., Tower M. I only made it 120 feet up a 430-foot tower, not even halfway. I felt like such a failure. It was cold, and when my muscles were tired, I stopped to rest. But then I would start to shiver, and I needed to move to be warm, and I would resume climbing. The rigger accompanying me informed me that it was just as difficult, if not more so, going down as it was going up. And so at 120 feet, we descended. I felt like such a failure. 120 feet is nothing on these towers. A few months later, I tried again on Tower C, the last tower standing, 250 feet. I made it to the top of this one, up to the beacon. It took an hour and a half to get to the top. I was disappointed it took me so long. I felt like I must have been out of shape and in poor physical condition. An hour to climb 250 feet seemed absurd. I had to keep stopping to catch my breath. A few days later, I was at the hospital getting x-rays. Apparently, I had a lung infection that had been festering for months. Back in February, when I attempted to climb Tower M in minus 30-degree weather, demolition crew workers commented on my bad cough and told me to get it checked out. I retorted that it was nothing. Just my asthma. I was fine, and I kept filming long days in the cold, out on the ice in the marsh. Finally, in April, after successfully climbing the last tower, I was bedridden with a lung infection that took me out of commission for at least a few months afterwards. Better later than sooner. A dream one night. I was climbing one of the radio towers. A storm was gathering. The sky was green and purple and dark. I made it to the top of a tower alone, and once at the top, I was about to climb out to the edge of the overhang when I was confronted with a human-sized spider. The spider had built a large web that was blocking my way. I climbed down underneath the overhang like a child on monkey bars and made it out to the edge. But when I turned to come back, the spider was blocking my way and had webbed off the bottom from where I had climbed. In an attempt to get down to safety, I pushed the spider off the tower and watched it fall. On the way down, it transformed and took human form, and I woke from the dream horrified. The image of a green and purple sky lingered, along with that of the spider, and watching a person fall from the top of a tower. The next morning was the first day I began my sound recordings. I parked my car on the public access road in the marsh, gathered my recording equipment and my tool belt, and hiked through the tall grasses of the marsh into the radio field. At the base of Tower C, there was a gigantic spider. And I was relieved. It was walking around, crawling, living, as if the spider from my dream had survived the fall. Bizarre and unconnected, I know. But still, I dreamed of a spider on the tower the night before, and I found one on its base the next day. For the rest of the summer and fall, I found such large spiders on every single tower. It was perhaps the best place to build webs for them. Such wide open marshlands, such high winds, their webs caught such large insects, and the spiders grew fat with their prey. Their webs were like miniature versions of the RCI antenna. They were like the wires that they were built on, small, silk-like webs within large copper RF webs. On February 4th, 2014, I attempted to climb Tower M, the tallest of the 13 towers. I passed my climbing certification exam and got the necessary safety equipment and insurance. A rigger went with me for safety. I made sure not to mention my dream about the spider. It was cold and windy, and at times my fingers were so numb I had difficulty manipulating the carabiners on my safety rope when I needed to stop to rest. Having sympathy for me, the rigger would occasionally climb up around on the outside of the ladder to help me with the carabiners when my fingers were obviously cold and fumbling. When he came into my line of vision, climbing in front of me, I couldn't help but remember my dream. The part where I watched the spider fall and transform into a human body. The image of watching a human body fall from the tower. I couldn't get the image out of my head. And I was so afraid that just as I saw a spider the morning after the dream, perhaps I would also see a human fall because of me. If I went to the top, I was so afraid that if I kept going, I would watch this man fall to his death. To be sure, he was a rigger, and this was his job, and he knew what he was doing. But I couldn't shake the image. With every rung I climbed, I saw his tumbling body in my mind. And soon I became paralyzed with fear. No doubt, he thought it was a fear of heights, or for my own safety. I didn't dare to share the absurd idea that I was more afraid for a qualified and experienced rigger than for myself. Or perhaps I was afraid more for myself than for him. But instead of a fear of falling, mine was a fear of witnessing. I was more afraid to witness the fall of another than to fall myself. And so, on the pretense of cold and fatigue, at 120 feet, we stopped the ascent and began the just as long climb back down to the ground. The towers fell in winter because the ground was frozen. Even on the frozen marsh, their height and their full weight planted their masts deep in the ground after being hauled away for scrap metal. Many of them left crevices that filled with salt marsh water, even in the frozen death of winter. One night, after the workers left, and all but one tower had fallen, I stayed behind alone to film sunset from the roof and to survey the now barren landscape, now that the towers had all been torn down. After getting my gear from the van and climbing it piece by piece up onto the roof, it was dark. Filmed the landscape from the roof, and the towers lay across the field like corpses. After filming, I gathered my equipment and climbed down, carrying it piece by piece from the roof to the van, back up from the roof to the van, back up from the roof to the van. Once everything was packed, it was dark, crisp, and cold, and the sky was filled with stars. I was about to climb into the van and head back into town to reload my magazines for the next day, when I stopped, closed the van door, and stood still under the stars. I realized that this may very well be my last time ever on this site. I left the van and my camera equipment and headed out into the radio field. I walked alone in the snow, under the stars, So strange. There were no more red lights in the night. Only soft white stars in the distance. And the moon. The moon was out, and its light on the snow lit my path. I walked up to each of the fallen towers. Mere inanimate objects. Metal laying in the snow, and nothing more. And yet they had such an air of corpses about them. I walked up close, snow crunching beneath my steel-plated work boots in the moonlit snow. And I laid my hand on the tower. Instantly, my eyes welled with tears, as if in grieving. I can't explain it. I knew it was just metal. But it was as if some sort of molecular vibration that had lingered in the steel, as if 67 years of high voltage and RF radiation lingered in the steel, as if all of the voices and stories and music and energy of all the people who spoke through and who listened to the transmissions, as if all of this somehow, as if the electromagnetic energy of all those people's voices and stories had somehow registered and taken up residence in these fallen towers. As if the steel had a memory. As if the steel was mourning. Not only for itself, but also for all the listeners who would no longer hear these voices and stories. I laid my hand on the tower, as if in a futile attempt of faith healing or comfort or last rites. I knew that all of those ideas were absurd, but I couldn't help myself. Just like filming them falling, I felt compelled. Like, I felt as if someone had to witness it. They couldn't fall alone. And now that they were down, I felt compelled to touch them. As if they needed comfort before crossing over. I knew that all of this was absurd, and yet still my hand was drawn as if by magnetism to touch them. Not a light touch, but heavy. Once my palm was on the surface of the base, I leaned on it with all of my weight and wept. I walked from the base to the top of the tower that was now within my reach. The top of the tower that now lay planted deep in the snow and the slushy, wet, saltwater marsh. And I did the same. I planted my hands. I leaned on it with all my weight, and I wept. And then I walked back to the base. I planted both of my hands on the tower, leaned with all of my weight, and gently kissed its lead paint with my lips, as if in some sort of ritual. I stood as long as I could in the cold, taking in as much as possible, knowing that I could never take it all in, that I would never be able to fully share this experience with anyone. I stood beneath the moon, in the absence of the red lights, refusing to accept that there was nothing more I could do. In denial. And when acceptance slowly came, and when I grew tired, and I turned my back on the towers and slowly walked back to the van and drove to town, where I unloaded my film magazines and prepared to send it to the lab, it was finished. It was over. Thank you. that's the last of the stories I have in my notebooks. But we're not quite at 1 o'clock, so I'll share another story or two from memory as I listen to the contact mic recordings. Right now we're listening to Tower O. Tower O had some of the nicest sounds. These sounds that you're hearing haven't been EQ'd or processed. These are the raw contact microphone recordings of the Radio Canada International radio towers. So I was recording in the fall of 2013. The site was no longer operational at that point. And there wasn't much staff. There was some. In the end, I found it easier to go when no one was there, hiking in from the back. And I remember I was out there on a weekend, and it was fall, and the leaves had changed, and I was out in the marsh grass with my tool belt and a sweater, and I had my headphones on, and listening to sounds like this, what we're hearing right now, and all of a sudden there was a piercingly loud bang that hurt my ears intensely, and then another one, and then I realized it was gunshots. It was hunting season. People were out hunting ducks, and I could hear the sounds of their bullets being amplified by the radio towers. And at that moment, I realized I wasn't wearing hunter's orange. I was out there in a khaki green sweater, camouflaged, basically. But I don't think I look like a duck, so I think I was okay. And on the note of ducks, the other interesting thing was that I wasn't expecting my contact microphones to pick up too much ambient sound. I was expecting them to mostly just catch the vibrations of the towers. But again, it was autumn, and at one point, I was recording Tower Q, which is not what we're listening to now, but maybe I can pull it up for you. Tower Q, a huge flock of geese flew by, and as the geese flew by, they were actually amplified by the tower. So here I'm going to fade out what we're listening to now. And I'm going to pull up Tower Q so you can hear how the geese sounded when they were amplified by the tower. I'm going to find tower. So all of the towers were identified by letter, and not all of the letters of the alphabet were there because some had been taken down over time. So I'm going to open this file. So Tower Q, this is what it sounds like when you have contact microphones on a radio tower and a flock of Canada geese fly by. I'm not sure if people would identify those as geese if they didn't know. I mean, when I hear this recording, to me, I hear the geese because I was there and I saw them fly by and I knew that that was what it was. So every time I hear it, I hear the geese. It's strange with a lot of these recordings. It's almost impossible to know how they read to other people outside of their context. The other thing here, I'll pull up another one. Tower F is quite lovely as well. I found that the ladder made quite nice sound. This is actually the ladder of Tower F. It has just a nice subtle rumbling to it. Over time, each tower seemed to develop its own voice. They all made their own sounds. Here we have Tower N. That's back to Tower F. And now to Tower N. So you can really hear a difference in their voices. And of course, different days, different wind speeds. These are diversions. I'm talking about the towers when I'm supposed to be telling you stories about the experiences of filming, so I'll share one more story. It's not a sound that got away, those stories I finished reading a few minutes ago. When I was filming in the winter, I wound up sleeping in the control facility. They have bunk beds there for the staff, and I had a lot of equipment. I had no crew because I didn't get much warning before the demolition crew arrived. In fact, I got a phone call the day of saying, the demolition crew arrived, they're here now. And so I had no time to gather a crew. And luckily I had my own camera and I booted it down there. And the crew was working from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day, so 10-hour days. But if I wanted to film what they... Throughout that time, I needed a couple hours to set up, so I needed to start setting up my gear around 5 a.m. because I was shooting 35mm film, so I had magazines to load and unload, and then I would film until sunset, and, well, in a bit after sunset to get some night shots. So I was generally working on my film magazines and cans and everything till 10 or 11 at night, and then up at 5 a.m. So the idea of loading and unloading and moving from different locations was tricky, so luckily I was able to sleep right in the building. And what's interesting is that the building wasn't heated, or barely, because when it was operational, the transmitters ran such high power. Each transmitter drew upwards of 14,000 volts. They drew so much voltage and power that they actually had to keep the building cool. So there were all these cooling systems in place, but no heating. There was some little electrical space heaters, but it wasn't much. So I found myself sleeping with a sleeping bag and a sound blanket and, you know, my winter clothes in the bunk, which was in the basement of the control facility. And that's probably what led my cough to develop into a lung infection when filming. Getting close to 1 a.m., so I'm going to leave you with a very different sound. I'm going to leave you with the sound of one of the towers falling. If this file is what it claims it is. Bring you back to Sounds Institute on location. The sounds from the roof of the truck, Mobile 49. This has been Amanda Dawn Christie recording live from Mobile 49, M49, at the Wave Farm on WGXC Wave Farm Radio. And now you're listening to the sound of the woods at night.